Chapter 5. Poincaré and Queloz. As determined as the French politicians were to make war, it was still necessary for them to stampede the mass of Frenchmen in the direction of war. Here politicians like Poincaré found the covert aid of Russian agents invaluable. It was a strange but mutually beneficial arrangement. The Russians subsidized the French newspapers, which plumped for military and financial support of Russia, enabling the Russians to dispose of even more funds for bribery. The warmongers in French politics reaped the rewards of the endless press drumbeat of hostility against the Central Powers, Germany and Austria. There was little difficulty in finding newspapermen of sufficient venality to allow their headlines and editorials to be scripted by a foreign power. In fact, the problem for the Russians was to pick and choose from among the throng which crowded forward, hungry for bribes. Arthur Rafalovich, the Russian finance minister's delegate in France, reported back to his prime minister, Count Witt, "Since it is impossible to buy everybody, it will be necessary to make a selection." He added, "Every day you learn to despise someone else." From the outset in 1912, the Russian bribemasters ladled out hundreds of thousands of gold francs. An ever-increasing tempo of subventions soared to 350,000 gold francs per month. The total outlay finally reached the tens of millions. After the Bolsheviks seized power in 1917, they published secret documents revealing the extent as well as the particulars of the shabby business, among them another Rafalovich telegram, this one to Ambassador Izvolsky: "You will deliver this money by means of confidential direct payments person to person in recompense for the cooperation accorded you in Le Temps, Le Clair, and Echo de Paris." February 26, 1913. One of Poincaré's allies wrote, "Of the publications in the pay of the Panslavists, an abominable list, where we see lumped together in the same activity and the same disgrace Le Figaro of Gaston Calmette, the Radical, the Journal de Debats, Henri Letellier's Journal, La République Française, Le Matin, L'Echo de Paris, and L'Eclair, and dominating all the rest of the future peace negotiator and future president of the Council of Ministers, the Foreign Bureau Chief of Le Temps, André Tardieu." Tardieu, whom we have just seen at work in Romania, had been a particular feather in the Russian cap. Several years before, his paper had been quite sympathetic to Austria-Hungary. In a letter to St. Petersburg dated February 16, 1911, Izvolsky wrote, "In the newspaper Le Temps, Monsieur Tardieu makes use of every opportunity to show the Franco-Russian rapport in an unfavorable light." A year later, the ambassador could write, "M. Tardieu has lost no time putting his pen at my disposal." The Serbian government was not slow to enter the bribery game after the example of their Russian patrons. As Dragomir Stefanovich revealed, the Serbs provided key French newspapers with upwards of 1.5 million gold francs in the 2 years before Sarajevo, little gratuities, in the words of Prime Minister Pašek. Serbian funds set up the influential Balkan agency of Le Temps, run by the ubiquitous Tardieu, which supplied French papers with a good 90% of their material from the Balkans. Russia's minister to Serbia, Hartwig, played a role in its direction, and the agency possessed its own code, which not even the French government could decipher. In the face of this bought and paid for press onslaught, the French public could not long remain unswayed. As one of Clemenceau's colleagues later wrote, "The most audacious claptrap and the most shameless lies, once they had been published and commented on by Le Temps, Echo de Paris, and the Journal de Debats, which at that time were considered by our ruling classes to be truly and scrupulously informed organs of the press, and hence worthy of complete confidence, were copied by all the provincial newspapers. They were taken for gospel by millions of both lower and upper middle class citizens, by retired persons, by workers, and by peasants, who for 20 years saw their savings go in loans to Russia, friend and ally, while waiting to sacrifice their lives for her." Poincaré did nothing to obstruct the plans of the Russians to subvert France's free press. When Izvolsky had come to him in 1912 with an outline of his plan for corrupting the French press through bribery, he was quickly able to overcome his misgivings. Izvolsky's agent, one Davidov, handled affairs with Poincaré, who murmured sanctimoniously, it will be necessary to distribute the money as far as possible in successive small amounts and with a great deal of prudence and discretion. Poincaré dealt with an even seamier character, Lenore, whose job it was to hand over personally the bulging envelopes to the media masters. Poincaré later explained rather piously that he might have met Lenore only once, and in any case, never had occasion to talk with him. The fact that his Jewish finance minister, Klotz, soiled his hands more intimately in the sordid details hardly cleanses Poincaré, however. Klotz, who even demanded on occasion that the Russians make payments in advance, because of the generally difficult situation of the French cabinet, would end his career scandalously after the war in a criminal court. Despite the public's growing sympathy for Serbia and Russia, the French masses still had no stomach for war. Poincaré's policy was deemed too militaristic, particularly when the French president wished to extend the term of military service from 2 to 3 years in 1914. Despite a heightened press campaign, fueled by more Russian funds, Klotz, Rafalovich reported to St. Petersburg, demands a second slice. A big campaign is necessary for the 3 years, legislation, to be passed, the plan was voted down. The chief opposition to Poincaré's military plans was embodied, in the French establishment, by Joseph Queloz. Queloz, who died in 1944, is largely a forgotten figure today, but he was perhaps the most intelligent and competent French statesman of his time. Charles de Gaulle considered him the first European statesman to understand the essential role of the economy in public life. Like his adversary Poincaré, he was tough, imperious, authoritarian. Queloz and Poincaré were born enemies, destined to collide with one another in the course of their careers. Queloz, unlike so many of the French, was not a die-hard anti-German. He respected Germany's military strength, and considered that the Colossus across the Rhine could teach his own country important lessons about work, order, and modernization of industry. Queloz believed that the two nations should complement each other rather than carry on a rivalry exacerbated by differences in temperament and psychology. Each had much to offer, and the two might arrive at a remarkable symbiosis. All too late, many Germans and Frenchmen have come to see that Queloz was correct. Far better that the French should have ironed out their differences with Germans of the caliber of Otto von Bismarck, or even Count von Bülow, than that Adenauer, Chancellor of a truncated Germany, and de Gaulle, President of a France come far down in the world, for all its pretensions, should have buried the hatchet after 80 years of disastrous enmity. In 1914, it seemed that Queloz stood a strong chance of winning the elections and attaining the office of President of the Council of Ministers, which would force Poincaré, President of the French Republic, to entrust a good deal of the business of government to him. Then what would have become of Poincaré's passionate designs for regaining Alsace and Lorraine? Poincaré was bolstered in his struggle against Queloz by the fact that many Frenchmen, just as adamant about the lost provinces, detested Queloz for his reasonableness on the matter. At bottom, the French are an extremely chauvinistic people. For them, the Belgians are the little Belgians who speak a strange gobbledygook. The Spanish are semi-Africans, the English errant hypocrites, and the Americans scarcely better than semi-beasts. The outside world is of little interest to the French, they have no need to know it. Charles Maurras, the most French of French intellectuals, at the age of 40 had never visited French-speaking Belgium but once, on an excursion trip that lasted several hours. Pierre Laval, 11 times a cabinet minister, admitted to me that he had passed through Belgium only one time, via Liège in a sleeping car at night. To be sure, the French have seen enough of Europe in 10 centuries of conquest: Brussels, Rome, Madrid, Vienna, Berlin, Moscow, 20 separate invasions of Germany. But those matters they're loath to discuss. It was on just this aversion to foreigners and inability to see the other side of a political argument that Poincaré had based his political career. He had tirelessly agitated for a policy based on revenge and military strength. Queloz had swum against the stream of popular chauvinism, and it had gained him millions of enemies. In the vexed matter of the 3 years military term, Poincaré's advantages in playing to popular fervor bumped against the equally tenacious solicitude of many Frenchmen for their freedom and their skins. It was fine to agitate for Alsace and Lorraine in the bistros, glorious to cheer at the Bastille Day parade along the Champs-Élysées. Personal sacrifice, at the cost of life and limb, required more thought. Poincaré had to find some way to torpedo his rival. He found one in Kalos's weakness for women. Despite his baldness, Kalos had a winning way with the fair sex. Like many a French politician, he had cantered merrily from mistress to mistress. Indeed, as is the case with so many men in the public eye, the women ran after him. Hitler, who was quite prim in this matter, once showed me a drawer full of letters from beautiful women of all ages begging him to father a child for them. In love, Napoleon said it well, safety lies in flight. Many a time the emperor had to take to his heels. Kalos had not been so fleet of foot. After enjoying the charms of one of his admirers for a long time more or less in secret, he had married her. A pretty ash blonde named Henriette, who dressed stylishly. They were very much in love. Nothing really to reproach there, certainly by today's standards. And Poincaré should have been the last to snoop around this little idol, since his own gambols with a woman somewhat less than innocent had created a sensation, particularly when his lady love, after a decidedly unvirtuous career, had demanded that she and the old anticlericalist be married in secret before an archbishop. Nor would the man who was to be Poincaré's good right arm in the Operation Petticoat directed against Kalos, Louis Barthou, win any awards for exemplary virtue. George Malcolm Thompson has set the scene. In the early spring days of 1914, Kalos was a source of deep anxiety to President Poincaré. In May there would be elections, popular sentiment was running towards the left. It would be difficult then to deny Kalos the premiership. Kalos, who in his boundless self-confidence believed he could strike a bargain with Germany. It would be the end of Poincaré's policy of rigid hostility to the power beyond the Rhine, of intransigence which only just stopped short of provocation. The 12 Days, page 66. Poincaré and his lieutenants devised a plan to wreck Kalos's prospects involving, not surprisingly, the press. Le Figaro, directed by the formerly impecunious Gaston Calmette, who enjoyed lavish subsidies from the Russians, he left 13 million francs in his will, began a campaign to destroy Kalos with these words on May 10, 1914, "The decisive moment has now come when we must not shrink from any action, even though our morals and personal inclinations may condemn it." In short, the newspaper had acquired Kalos and his wife's love letters, written at the time she was his mistress. Kalos signed himself, Jojo, Henriette, Riri. The letters were exactly the stuff that lovers have written one another across the ages, confessions of volcanic passion, sometimes in earnest, often believed, in any case never meant for prying eyes. On May 16th, when Riri cast her eyes on Le Figaro's front page, she discovered that the first of her Jojo's letters to her was the day's feature story. It was mushy stuff, no intimate details were spared. The paper announced the rest of the letters would appear in forthcoming issues. Madame Kalos threw herself into the arms of her husband. Sobbing, she implored him, "Are you going to let these journalistic hyenas invade our boudoir?" She had no mind to let them. After being turned away from an eminent Parisian magistrate, who shrugged his shoulders and offered, "That's the price of being in politics," she obtained a pistol, made her way to the offices of Le Figaro, where, upon gaining entrance to Calmette's office, she emptied all six bullets into her traducer. In point of fact, Madame Kalos should have aimed higher. The now defunct Calmette had been merely a hireling. As the news of Riri's revenge spread through Paris, an agitated Barthou rushed to his master in the presidential palace. As Poincaré later described the scene to the journalist P.B. Gussy, Barthou collapsed on Poincaré's desk, terrified by the fatal consequences of the articles. "I'm the one who wrote all the articles against Kalos," he exclaimed. "I'm to blame for the tragedy. I must punish myself." Needless to say, Barthou didn't punish himself. That's seldom the way in politics. He would be a minister several times over and remain the loyal henchman of Poincaré or whoever happened to be his patron at the time. His wife arrested like a common criminal, Finance Minister Kalos had little choice but to resign. The opposition, decapitated, posed no further threat to Poincaré's plans. Thereafter, Kalos was a figure of ridicule, even in the streets of Paris. His wife's trial in July was a sensation, as Henriette swooned in her seat like a heroine in a classic tragedy. Her acquittal was anticlimactic. By July 27, 1914, the day she was vindicated, war was a matter of hours away.